Hi, Bob Earl. I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. You said you can't hear. Is it better? Okay. I too am delighted to be a fundraiser, but I'll see you talking to Cliff, and those of you who are new and have that mind that still likes to think and figure things out, piece things together, the fact that we're in a elf's lodge and that there's a dead elk on the wall, there's no reflection on how we do it in Narcotics Anonymous or AA. So you're not in threat of being killed and hung on the wall if you fuck up. It's okay. I listen to my talk, and like, you talk about looking cool, I'm like, oh, if that does not end because we stopped using chemicals. I don't remember for a long time. It was important to me. I mean, I would go up and talk to a newcomer after a meeting, and I couldn't hear a word he was saying because I really didn't care if the son of a bitch lived or died. It was actually the blonde over here I was interested in. So my whole concentration was on looking good, listening to, looking attentive, listening to the new person and wondering how good I look. So if you're not looking good, you'll find that most of your life is limited to your own reflection. Because you'll spend more time with it than you will anything else on the planet. I'm it. This is just what all controversy was about. Seems kind of silly, doesn't it?
I'm impressed. Christ, it always...
Whenever NA cancels me on anything, I'm always flattered that they take that much time, Whatever it is I have to say is so frightening that they don't want me to say it. Nothing I say ever scares me. My thinking terrorizes me on a daily basis. But my usually can filter it before it reaches the mouth. Not always. I heard an Al-Anon speaker a while back who really kind of got my attention with one line. She said, Sponsor came up to her and said, now that you're recovered or in recovery, your responsibility is to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. So if you leave here tonight, piss off. Understand, I know that. I'm aware. I would much rather give a different talk than I give. If you think bopping around the country to Iowa and talking about being a vegetarian is a thrilling way to live, forget it, the deep raising states take highly when you come. It's like talking about not smoking in North Carolina, I didn't choose any of this. It was not my idea, but you'll learn at some point in your recovery, if you stay recovered, eventually your life becomes none of your business. Unlike Mike, I did not go crazy in my first 30 days in recovery. I would have to say that my first 90 days in recovery were probably the best 90 days I'd had for quite a while. I was so gone, so fried, the chemicals had done so much damage, that I was a lot like a little automaton. I would just sort of led around by people, sit here and put your hand up. Drink this. And it was really that. It was just follow directions. I didn't know what was a good meeting, what was a bad meeting, who was a good AA, who was a bad AA. I didn't know who was anything. I didn't know where the hell I was. And I didn't care. It really didn't matter. The first 90 days were really sort of blissful. So if you're here tonight and you're new and you really feel destroyed, completely destroyed, relax. That may not be as bad as you think. I found that it was after that initial period. It was when I began to think again. And I became aware of something. Once I begin to think again, the mind kicks into gear. Now, I don't know what your mind is. Well, I really do. I don't know why I say that. Your mind is as much jelly as mine is. Its basic goal in life is to destroy you. Not me. It doesn't have enough energy left over after whipping your ass to come after me. You couldn't stay awake long enough to hate me like you stay awake to hate you. But once that mind began to kick into gear again, its real first concern was my secret. It didn't want the secret out. And once I've been clean, like 90 days, 120 days, first sometime in the first few months, I became aware one more time now I had to protect my secret at all costs. Simple secret, no big deal. Something's wrong with me. Something is wrong with me, and in any circumstances, anywhere, anytime, I am not enough. Enough. I know that. You don't. Because that's my secret. And I will die to keep you from finding it out. So now, I wake up and I am 90 days, 120 days, 6 months, clean, whatever the hell I am, this new organization with new people, and I don't know how to relate to these people, or what they say, or what they do, or how they behave. So I begin to do what I've done all my life in new situations with new people. I become an observer. I watch them. I watch to see how they stand, how they walk, how they talk, what they do, so that I can become one. Okay? Because if I just be me, I'm finished. If I let you see Bob, you're going to ask him to leave. So I can't be me. So I begin to create what I now call my recovery personality. And I watch these people and I take a piece from this speaker and a piece from this speaker and a piece from this sponsor and a piece from this sponsor and a piece from this evangelist on TV and a piece from this person over here and a piece from this person. And I create this personality, this recovery personality. And I take him to meetings. He doesn't have anything to do with who I am. I mean, it's almost like Superman in the phone booth, you know, changes into his underwear and his cape, right? It's like I would get out of my car in the parking lot at the meeting. And in a little walk from the car to the meeting hall, I would transform
into Bob, the recovered person.
Now, in observing people, one of the critical aspects of formulating a good recovery personality, I learned, was that a real good person in a recovery program is always fine. Doesn't matter what's happening in their life, they're always fine. And I learned this from a simple exercise. I would walk in the meeting and walk up to George and say, "Hi, George, how are you?" George would say, "I'm fine, thanks. How are you?" I said, "I'm all right. I'm fine." And George would walk off, and Bill would come rushing over and say, "Did you hear what happened to George?" I'd say, "No, what happened to George?" "Oh, God, his wife divorced him this morning, served him with divorce papers, he lost his goddamn job, and repossessed his car, and one of his kids is in the hospital." So I go, "Oh, okay, I understand, no matter what happens, you're always fine." Well, as I began to carry this recovery personality from meeting to meeting, and day to day, and week to week, and month to month, and year to year, and have smart sponsorship, they just keep you busy. See? Because their recovery personality doesn't know what the hell to do with you either. You know? They also created a person off of another person off of another person. I mean, the people that we have been created from are dead already. You know, where the hell they are, right? So I see that stress begins to mount anxiety. Well, anxiety is my drug of choice in recovery. You know, this is the only one that can really get me going now. It's the only one allowed.
Find something to worry about quick. And then you'll know you're alive.
Peace of mind resembles death. So I hit year one, none of these sponsors know what the hell to do with me. They just know I seem tense. So to give me more people to sponsor and just a slew of panels and institutions. I don't want to do any of this crap. I don't want to sponsor people. I don't want to go to an institution. Everybody always walks around with this charming gratitude smile.
I'm so grateful they asked me to come.
Give me a rest, will you?
Drive 200 fucking miles on Sunday in the blistering heat to a federal penitentiary where you don't even want AA in the first place? Wonderful way to spend Sunday. You know, everybody should do it. Thrilling. Or have your meeting in a county camp in the television room. The meeting is from 7 to 8. There are 92 guys present for the meeting. 7 are there for the program. 85 are holding their seats until the TV comes on. Highly attentive and participatory audience. But we're great. We were a match made in heaven. I get up and say, my name is Bob Earl. I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. I don't really much give a fuck if any of you ever see The Free World Again. And my speaker is Bill. Let's sit down. I have done my part. So I was busy, and I kept carrying this guy around in personality. And a friend of mine put it better than anybody I've ever. He said, we create a statue with the help of the people. And if you become real active and become a speaker, this is even more true. You create this statue with the help of the people, and then you become like a maintenance man, a janitor of the statue. And even the people I become involved with in relationships, I mean, I just bring the female in, help clean the virtue off the statue. You know, it's like,
keep the statue to me, keep the statue looking good, you know, walk the statue around town.
So while all this is going on, I'm quietly going nuts on the inside. Each day that goes by, I'm getting crazier and crazier. I mean, we're talking seriously over the edge, right? Forget walking the edge. Gone. But if you walk up to me in a meeting and say, hi, Bob, how are you? I'm fine. Thank you very much. In fact, the truth would have been, if you walked up to me and said, hi, Bob, how are you? If I had been really truthful, I would have dropped to my knees, grabbed you around the ankles, and had begun to sob uncontrollably on your shoes. Because that's how it really was. That's how it really was inside of me. But had I done that, the secret would have been out. The secret would have been out. You would have known that something was wrong with me and that I am not enough. So, when you say, how are you, Bob? I'm fine, thanks. How are you? And that's a lie. I'm not fine. I'm nice. I'm stressed out. I'm completely goddamn insane. I don't know my own name. I'm scared to death. I don't know where the hell I'm going or where I've come from. I don't know what my life is going to be. I'm worried all the time. I wake up fucking insane, you know. The day is too much and one eye is open. I'll never get through this day, you know. But I'm fine. I'm fine because like so many of our members and so many of our recovery programs, which are all at war with each other, which I find funnier than hell from the get. Right? I mean, this makes a lot of sense. Like, every fucking your diet out there trying to prove we were unique. And we come in here and try and keep it up. Yeah? Oh, he's one of them. Sit him over there. And we all, and you know why it exists? It exists, in my opinion, because we're comfortable with that. See, most of us were raised in dysfunctional households by dysfunctional parents. Most of us were raised by addicts and alcoholics. I mean, I don't know what kind of sponsors you picked when you first came to this program. I picked people that treated me like dog shit. You know, they talked to me just like my father. Sit over there, asshole, what's up? We're not even down to the upstairs, we'll break your back. You know, move the fucking kid. Okay with me, I'm comfortable. You know, like home. Hi, Dad. Nice to see you concerned about me. Now would you take your foot off my throat? And I don't know if it's bad that we do that. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying it's been my experience that we do that. Maybe we wouldn't know. I don't know that I would have known how to respond to somebody if they had been kind and loving and supporting
and patience and said things to me like, you are an incredibly valuable human being as you are this moment. And as you are this moment, learn to love yourself. Do you remember that one? Did anybody ever tell you that one? Go home and look in the mirror, son, and tell you yourself that I love you. Certainly. One of the, if you have a mind like mine, that's one of the easiest exercises in recovery.
I would go home and line up with the mirror.
Oh, you're the sickest son of a bitch. And I would walk away from the mirror, convinced that that's true. And nobody was around telling me any different. Nobody was telling me any different. One of the things that I find fascinating is that, see, a lot of what I've discovered now, recovery, I've been clean and sober for over 24 years now, and it's a long time. And the interesting thing about that is that I'm just sort of getting going here, you know? I mean, I feel like, you know, I mean, I'm not even the least bit bored, tired, disgusted, disturbed, or anything else. I'm like thrilled to death, you know? I'm just getting smoking down the trail. And I'm getting all this wonderful information and stuff going on. And I get to experiment, try things, you know, and then I get to share them and get hated by everybody and move on down the trail. And one of the things I've discovered is fascinating is that everybody harps upon it as how essential it is that we find God. I agree. And how essential it is that we be able to walk the spiritual path. I agree. Absolutely, 100%. That's what all this is about. That's all it is about. You can put any label on all this recovery that you want, in any organization you want, and the reality it is just to raise our spiritual consciousness and put us to the oneness with God. That's it. That's what it was designed to do. That's honors. And whatever spirits sent us to them. I love when people get upset today, when people go outside to try new things while they're in their recovery. You know? Give me a choice on any given day to go sit in the clubhouse with Henry, who is 35 years clean and sober and spent 35 years in the clubhouse in the same chair, drinking coffee out of the same cup, smoking cigarettes into the same ashtray with the same yellow-stained fingers, with the same diabetic pale skin from eating 36 pounds of sugar a day. Or give me a chance to go down with some guy to a 4 a.m. trampoline meditation class on the beach. Guess where I'm going? I ain't going to the clubhouse. Not if everything everybody said about if you want what we have. I want to go down to the beach and see what's going on in the trampoline. What did they learn down there? Do you get close to God, the higher you jump? I mean, I want to know. You're up. Gotta be something here, let me go see what's going on here. And people go nuts. Of course, it always says, open-mindedness is critical to recovery, but we seem to forget that. That seems to only apply with certain issues, not all issues, interesting. I wonder who made that rule up in their open-minded moment. And then we forget that the founders of all of this, good old Bill and Dr. Bob, used to hold seances at Dr. Bob's house. I used the Ouija board. They used to have mediums in to talk to the goddamn spirits. Guys, like, what were you, for Christ's sake? These were our founders. You know, how much of what we got came from ghosts. You know? And we walk around here all serious and, this is it. This is the letter of the law. But the letter of the law, everyone should read the part about God will constantly disclose more of you to us. Ask him. More will be revealed as we trust. Yet we seem not to want to hear any of this crap. We don't want to hear it. What you eat is how you are, who you are. You know? I don't care what stuff you're working if you're in a sugar coma. Yeah, I don't care. It doesn't make any goddamn difference. It won't change a thing. It'll come out of it as whacked out as you did the day that you didn't work in a sugar coma.
Yeah,
this is
all good. We're in it. We're just going to help them all.
My energy seems to be on a low ebb. I can't understand why. So if you're going to live a spiritual life and follow a spiritual path and get close to your God, one of the ingredients that I have found over the years from all the teachers that I have talked to and all the places that I have been, that is absolutely essential to any spiritual life ever, anywhere, for any reason, is spontaneity. The capacity to be spontaneous. The ability to change in a moment's notice. That is essential. Absolutely essential. And I wandered in the door of this program, like most of my brothers and my sisters who I'm really close to, with absolutely no self-esteem at all. And the one thing that will keep you from being spontaneous in your life is no self-esteem. So what was being asked of me by my friends in the fellowship and asked of me by the program, I didn't have enough self-esteem to be able to get next to. See? Because I did not know how to be spontaneous. Because to be able to be spontaneous, in my opinion, you've got to be okay with who you are. I've got to be able to walk around the corner and not know who's going to be there and what's going to happen in advance. And just say, hi, I'm Bob. Who are you? I don't do things like that. I have friends throughout years of recovery who have been raised by normal parents. This son of a bitch used to drive me insane when we go places. He always asked questions. If he didn't know something, he'd ask somebody. And it would infuriate me. Because you cannot look good and ask a question at the same time. I don't care how much your watch costs, how much what clothes you got on, how expensive your car is, how graceful your stance, how big your muscles are, or how big your breasts. It does not matter. You look dumb asking a question.
Pardon me, sir. What is that?
I remember going to a sushi bar with this guy one time. We both went for the first time. Neither one of us had ever been in one. He went from one, the sucker was as long as a stage, I think longer, seemed longer, like a block. He started at one end and worked his way all the way to the other end, asking what each thing was. Was it cooked? Was it not cooked? Was it fresh? Was it not fresh? What did it taste like? What kind of consistency? Would someone having sushi for the first time enjoy it, or would they get a tool of wonder? Did you ever try to look good when you're stuck in a social situation with somebody like that? I much prefer the figure it out method. Watch from the shadows. Don't let anyone know you don't know. Slide into the crowded part. Point to what you want for fear you'll mispronounce it. And look good while you're trying to eat squid.
People say to me, oh, go home, surrender to God, you'll feel better.
Sure, of course. Every drug addict feels better when he surrenders to God. I mean, that's what we come in here with a burning desire to do, turn ourselves over to God. All right, God, I know I made a few minor errors in judgment, possibly even a couple of them pissed you off, but what the hell, I mean, you know, you let bygones be bygones and go on from here, can't we? We don't have to be serious about this stuff, do we? I go home, kneel down to pray, bow my head, fold my hands, and the minute I got quiet, my mind would say, forget it. Don't pray. God works for the good guys, and you are not one of the good guys. So I forget it. But I hear people who pray, and they got help, but I couldn't pray. Because if I had to pray, I had to risk something would change in my life. This one I love. So I enjoy sharing it. There is no pain in change. There is absolutely no pain in change. None. Zero. The pain is in the resistance to change. It is the moment before you let go. It's the final moments when you're curled up in the corner of your living room at home alone. You try to call 17 people, none of whom are home. And at that point, with your best spiritual face, you hurl the phone across the room. And you scream, we'll go on to the next thing now. You just let go. People always say, how do you know God's will? How do you know what God's will is? I just can't tell. Get up in the morning, go out the door, start moving, and when you hit a wall, turn left. It is that complicated. That's how difficult it is, that's how ethereal it is, that's how complex it is. Get up in the morning, go out the door, start moving, when you hit a wall, turn left. That's it. That's all there is to it. Of course, now, I have some problems with that philosophy. I'll get moving down the road and hit the wall. Oh. Oh, not what I had in mind. Well, there's not a lot of distraction here. Stand a lot of distractions. I guess I'll stay a while. I've heard people say that the only difference between a rut and grave is dimensions. And if you show the attic the rut, he'll move in furniture. Now, of course, the flip side of that one is you see the wall ahead of you down the road, so you get back 150 yards and get a running start at it. Forget turning left, your goal is to go through. If you're lucky, you'll ricochet off to the left. If you're unlucky, you will go through the wall. You will wind up on the other side of the wall, sitting in the garbage dump, saying,
this isn't where I had
wrong. How did I wind up here? One of the major complaints I always have is that my opinion and my observation has been in recovery programs you can get more support for failure than you can success. I know. Feel that by the time it's over. And if any of this keeps you up all night, I hope not, because I sometimes change my mind on the way back home, you know? So, I was talking a couple of months ago to the most enlightened person that I've ever spent time with in my life ever, anywhere, in any circumstances, any time. And like all people who have evolved way beyond the bullshit that we live with here, he's a very silly person. And he loves a lot. Isn't it piss you off? I mean, those that have been out there experimenting, meeting these people, trying to do nuts, you know, you go looking for the suit and answering it, and you do. Enlightened, and I asked about enlightenment. I mean, that's the word, isn't it? That's the question, isn't it? Enlightenment. Is that the answer, the solution? Isn't that going to make me okay? What's enlightenment? And what that means? Wow. I think this is very funny. I've been dying trying to find the right combination for enlightenment, you know, the right period of time for prayer, the right meditation, the right words, the right position, the right posture, you know, my face is sun, my face is sun, do I sit here, go there, the beach, just walking, self-realization fellowship, or on the lake, do I go to Oregon and work? You know, dressed in red and contribute to the Rolls Royce fund, and what do I do here? You know, how do I get the enlightenment? You know, this guy gives a giveaway, he's talking to anybody, going to learn that enlightenment just means lighten up.
I don't lighten up well. Everything's very serious to me, because everything was very serious when I was a child. Seriousness was life and death. See? I mean, man, if I wasn't serious and didn't pay attention and wasn't alert and wasn't in control, I could get killed. One dumb move would be the end. You know?
One wrong giggle? You can't giggle in a house filled with paranoia. They know who you're laughing at. You know. And women in the program are always upset at men in the program, right? The big bitch is,
you guys are not in touch with your feelings.
They have meetings in Southern California for women who are in relationships with men who were not in touch with their feelings. The thing that fascinates me about that is, why the hell are they still in the relationship and going to a meeting to fix it if that's the case? You know, it seems to me there should be meetings for women who are going to meetings for, you know, giving.
How come we are at that point, guys? Why can't we express our feelings? Why can't we take that risk?
And let somebody see who we really are. And of course, not off on this cheap ass muscle. We almost died behind that. I know why I can't. I was 2.5, 3 years old, fell off my tricycle, came into the house. Blood coming out of my knee. Serious problem. First time blood had ever come from my body. In its short little life, and I was in pain, and I was in tears, and I approached the trustworthy alcoholic father in the chair with a can of beer, tears streaming down my face.
I got my knees numb.
Knock off the crying.
I can't stop crying, my knees numb.
If you don't stop crying, I'm going to give you something to cry about.
But I can't stop my knees.
Okay. They give birth to an idiot. I worked that one out. You don't cry. I was about 2.5 then. 15.5 years later, I was delayed in Georgia Street Emergency Receiving Hospital in downtown Los Angeles with a surgeon about to remove a couple of bullets from my body that belonged to the Los Angeles Police Department. And I looked the surgeon in the eye and I told him, pick his anesthetics, pick it in his ass. My father would have been proud. Unfortunately, I fainted when he was about 1/2 inch in for the first bullet. But there was a moment of looking good, you know? One fleeting moment before I passed out. Well, you know why we can't express our feelings, Colonel? That's why we can't express our feelings, because most of us have our brains beaten in. For showing that we're frightened or that we're gentle or that we care or that we're scared and we're just little guys inside and we're not able to fix the world or move the world or change the world and we can't solve all your problems because we don't know how. My problems today in my life are from two sources, learned behavior and no information. That's all. I beat myself up constantly for not knowing how to do things that I would never talk. Never talk. No one ever taught me. No one ever gave me the information. And I will just grind myself because I don't know. Or, conversely, I'll participate in behavior that was taught to me. Yeah? And, you know, people say, what are we doing here? What's all this all about? Well, I know that as a very little child, it became necessary for me to stuff my feelings. And I know by the time I rolled into adolescence, which comes with its own set of problems. That's how we bring our son to me not long ago. The kid's 18, he got adopted until 16, whatever that was, 15. He's, you know, he's just an adolescent, he's going fucking nuts, so I think he's a awful now. It's your boy, me. Man, I chose to skip adolescence, you know. I selected morphine, methadone, and a few other chemicals combined together in magical combinations, which I kept trying to create. That's all I ever wanted. What did you ever look for? After your first few initial big bangs, you know, where you throw up all over your friends and you cave in your upper rib with your chin when your head falls and, you know,
you leave the kitchen off the chair to the table or the refrigerator into the sink because you happen to mix something with the speed you shouldn't have, and you got it in the vein in the neck, you blow it to the heart, you know, other things like this, other than those unusual big things. I don't know what the hell you ever looked for, but after that, man, I became a chemist. And I wanted one thing only.
When they're allowed to flow, control, they will upset your life. And worse than that,
they'll make you look silly.
You'll look silly.
You will come up with the inappropriate feelings at the wrong time. You take one of us in the morning and one of our neighbors, and we stroll down the walk to start our cars to go to work. My neighbor's car doesn't start, my car doesn't start. He goes back in the house, he calls the auto club. I go back in the house, I call suicide prevention. He has a micro bottle, his car is insurance. I have a meter when my life is over.
A feeling somewhat inappropriate to the situation.
People might even laugh at it.
So what? It is who I am at that moment. I have heard a guy put it better than any hammer. I spend all my energy trying not to be who I am. The easiest thing in the world for me to be is me. But I can't, because I'm afraid. I can't let you see me. I just can't do it. Because something's wrong with me. I'm not enough. My parents didn't love me. God doesn't love me. I'm not enough. It's really distracting, the conversation. Thank you very much.
I'm better. I would have, a couple years ago, just gone back to the motel and created dolls and stuck pins in them. That's what I do.
Now I try to shortcut that kind of emotional
upheaval in my life.
So I still have a little anxiety now and then. Mornings are still my finest hours. It's difficult. It's hard. It's
hard when you wake up with a mind that tells you that it must create problems to solve, God will fire it.
It's particularly difficult when you wake up in the morning and find your mind looking down at you from the headboard.
In the form of a very large meat-eating vulture. And I open one eye and my mind says, oh, good, good morning, glad you're awake. I want to talk to you.
You didn't get enough sleep.
Probably had 12 hours. That has nothing to do with it. The first line is always, I have not had enough sleep. You didn't get enough sleep. You shouldn't go to work today as tired as you are. But then if you don't go to work, you're going to fire you, so you have to go in. But going in as tired as you are, you're going to screw up and you're going to get fired. So what are you going to do now? Because you don't have enough money to last 6 weeks, you know. In 6 weeks, you're out of dough. And then how are you going to handle that? Oh, yes. Also, by the way, the bump just below your knee is bone cancer. How are you going to handle that? Are you going to go to meetings and talk about it or just stay home and you chicken shit lots of death, you know?
So I've been awake a full 5 seconds. I'm tired, unemployed, broken, dying from cancer.
Which doesn't make one want to leap up and greet the goddamn day, you know. The mind is wrong. I was having a talk with a friend of mine today who was saying something about who's trying to bring something to a logical conclusion before he participated in it. And I said,
do you understand how dangerous that is?
The only way possible you can arrive at a logical conclusion about anything is with information you already possess. And how much good information do you possess? Or would you rather go on into the twilight zone and see what's there instead? Because I can't take those chances anymore. Stuff that's logical to me is dangerous as hell. Because it means it computes with old stuff. I don't want any more old stuff. I have almost died in recovery for old stuff. I want new stuff. I'd rather walk into a room full of people in a building I've never been to before. I don't know any of the people, and I don't even know what they're doing inside the building. I had somebody take me to a dance thing last night in Los Angeles. They called me up like 11 o'clock at night in the hotel and said, I'm going to this place where it's free expression.
I'm also an old street drug addict and a Capricorn. Astrology means nothing to you, let me tell you. Capricorns are the most grounded, tight-ass sign in the whole thing, next to possibly the Leo. We will not move unless we see something that for us and it's got to be guaranteed in writing. Free expression? I'm a writer. I can't even begin to share from this podium what kind of images I can come up with for even free expression in some loft in Santa Monica. But I went anyway. Because I want to go now. Even though I'm scared, and I'm afraid I'm going to be made to look foolish, and all those other wonderful emotions, I go anyway. Screw it. And it was really an entertaining evening. It was really entertaining.
Well, this is a dance studio converted for people to dance.
Because I'm probably going to dance with somebody or without somebody. It doesn't matter. And a lot of the people there were just dancers who were just working out routines or just trying to break out of the routine and get free. That was some great stuff. Really entertaining. I even got it 3 times.
One to go to the bathroom, twice to dance.
Hey, the bathroom was first. That was bad enough, man. Water across the floor. You know, I'm into looking good. Things don't change. I'm into physical exercise. I had to finally give up on a goddamn health, the sports connection. Maybe okay when you're 20, but I gotta tell you, rolling in there at 50, there's some serious competition going on there. I have an adolescent who's still 17 years old, 18 years old inside of me, man. He knows what the goddamn iron pile is. He knows how to work on it. He knows how to put a lot of it up in the air, see? He forgets that another 43 years has gone by since then, or 33 years. Sexual relevance to him. He doesn't care. He doesn't care that all the guys have 20-inch waist and warm up with 400 pounds in the bench press to get loose. But if the girls warm up with 250 to get loose, you know, he just adopts the attitude he always adopts.
Hey, it's all right, fuck it.
I spent 3.5 months not working out because I ripped something out of my body somewhere, you know. So, just walking to the bathroom can be a big deal. What am I trying to say up here? I love feeling.
I didn't talk about drinking or using or recovery.
I love that. My hope for the fellowship is all of them, the kids. The kids are going to change it. And the reason the kids are going to change it, I know there's going to be a couple of you with a few years rolling through that 10 to 15 year period where you're in your absolute complete control of everything in the world. And the thought is, if this hollow thing being changed by the children is enough to give you a hemorrhoid, you know? But the children are going to change it because they're cursed. And you know what they're cursed with? They're cursed with information. They're crushed with information and awareness, and they will not settle. They will not see the beginning of recovery as the end. They will see the beginning of recovery as the beginning, period. You know? We had a couple of young guys roll in a couple of years ago in Southern California. These guys were crazy.
Right.
They had been vegetarian since they were children. They had been all over the goddamn world. They were seeking since they were kids. And don't forget, man, that this
This organization, these fellowships, were founded by seekers. They'll never stop looking, trying, experimenting, experiencing anything, anywhere. He was open to find more. He never rested. Okay? And these guys, man, they had been everywhere. They had spent a few years in India. They had walked the rivers with the yogis. They had lived in the caves with them. They had been in the Himalayas. They had watched the changing of the High Lama. They had spent time with the Tibetan monk. They had walked barefoot in the snow in Virginia Beach with Edgar Cayce's people. They had talked to spirits, let spirits come to them. They had been everywhere, and the only thing that was keeping them from assimilating the information they were getting was the heroin they were using. Created a small veil in them. Made it difficult for them to apply what they were experiencing. They walked in here, and we handed them a book. You know, we handed them a big book and said, here, man. Read this. And these are the only two people in my 24 years that I have seen react this way to the book. Wow! This is great! This is the best stuff I've ever seen. Look at this, man. Some of these principles they have been saying the Essene prophets were putting this stuff down 2,000 years before Jesus ever set foot on the earth, man. This is heavyweight stuff. This is great. By God, if you do that in that sequence, it's got to break through and allow you to become a oneness with your God. This is far out. Fucking great. You know, I mean, they were so excited about the book, they couldn't stand it.
Yeah. Those of us were around and were like, you know, going through their pockets, man, and see if there was still, some new designer drug we don't know the effects of out here. They're making it shrunk. What is going on with these guys?
They just loved it. They just took off with this stuff on the skyrocket.
One day, 6 months down the line, they walk into an illustrious, long-existent, long-standing clubhouse in Southern California. They're sitting by the door as a 33 year old member in his chair with his coffee cup with his yellow famous fingers smoking his cigarette, having his cup of coffee and striking his pile of cookies. One of the two kids looked down and said,
what the fuck are you doing? What the hell are you doing? For Christ's sake, Jesus, God has presented on this planet a program which will lift you from a disease that will kill you. Your life has been saved. You're given another chance at life. You have been given a chance for the biggest adventure ever, life, and you're sitting here in this chair, hurting yourself.
You know what the old man said for?
You're right.
You know what he said for? The answer. I want you to hear this astute answer. When you're sober as long as I am, you'll understand. Get ready, guys, because more of those kids are coming. They see this as one of the tools which will help them get it all. Get it all. And they want it all. And they believe they deserve it all. They don't understand anything else. And they know that smoking will kill you and drinking caffeine will kill you. And they know that sugar will keep you from your feelings. And they're hep to all of it because they got too much information and they're not going to tolerate it. In themselves or in other people. Interesting ones you're on is not to make you a really mad. Particularly if you're busy in the process of wiping yourself out in recovery. And we walk around here like it doesn't exist. We pretend like, no. Oh, it's okay. It's okay with you. It's okay with me. Makes me sad. It makes me angry because I know it's not okay with you. I know the only reason that I never took care of myself. It's because I didn't know how. I didn't know how. Nobody ever taught me how. I would drive me 100 miles to get to the best doctor. I won't drive me 5 miles. I'll go to this quack down the street and I've had a patient 7 months. That's good enough for me. That's where my holster's taking me. I understand. I know where I belong. I was taught early where I belong. What woke me up? A few things woke me up. The first real awakening I had in recovery was I met someone and fell in love, and the 2 years after we had dated for 2 years, and after 2 years of getting closer and getting to know each other and all the beauty that went into this particular relationship, we decided to get married. 1 month after we got married, we found out she had cancer. 3 months after we found out she had cancer, she died. At the time, when they informed her she had cancer, she made me promise, and she told our physician, who was a friend, who broke down and cried when he had to tell us, she said the one thing she did not want is toxic treatment. If the treatment could kill her, she wasn't interested in the treatment. So in those days, this was 13 years ago, it became necessary for us to seek treatments in other countries, and treatments, you know, by other means that were not really highly accepted in those days. And she made me promise that I would never, no matter what state she got into, subject her to any of that stuff. And I did. Anyway, all these people, the very first thing they wanted removed from her life was red meat and cigarettes. After she passed away, about a month later, I was sitting in a restaurant one night eating a steak, and I like this little light went on. This is awakening number one. She said, this is not necessary. You do not have to eat this anymore. So that was about 13 years ago. So probably 13 years since I've had any red meat or any pork. Continue to eat chicken, continue to drink coffee, continue to smoke cigarettes. A month later, I gave up coffee. Not caffeine, new coffee. Switched to diet cola. Like a non-compulsive obsessive personality, I got everybody drink 18 cans of tab a day. I got everybody out and had a can of tab and cigarettes in the morning. You know? I thought the taste of Rice Krispies, milk, sugar, and tab was compatible with everybody. I don't know. Fine with me. You know. And one day, I was researching the story on suicide. And I left suicide prevention in Los Angeles. I sat down in the boardroom with the head of suicide prevention in the boardroom. The door closed, and I lit up my Marlboro with my super electronic, you know, high-powered butane, whatever the hell the latest suicide torch was, and lit my cigarette, took a puff, looked around the room, and there was not one ashtray in the room. Okay, any serious smoker in a room with 11 people with no ashtrays knows he's not in a friendly crowd. So I'm looking to, you know, like put it out, and oh no, they're great. Okay, no problem. Wait, we'll get you an ashtray. I go to the outer office, remodels it, trying to find an ashtray. I tear things apart, bang, slam, comes back with a platter big enough to put a fish on. Set the goddamn thing in front of me, and I sit there and try to be nonchalant with this, you know, platter in front of me, have my Marlboro, you know. And the guy looked at me and then had a suicide prevention. He said, hey, look, we have an official opinion on cigarette smoking if you're interested. And I said, what is it? The answer did not come from here. This would like to smoke forever because it believes that it will go on after I die. It's convinced of it. Did you ever notice in real stress cases it always shoots itself right in the fucking head? It never thinks about anything else. So this little guy down here says, what is it? And the guy looks at me and says, well, now that all the scientific information is in, and it is a fact, no longer a theory, it's proven that cigarette smoking of and by itself will take your life. We view cigarette smoking to be covert suicide. It is a little tiny gun for a little tiny bullet. I was thrilled that I had asked. I was probably one of the most astute questions I'd asked up until that time, the writer. I can tell you that I walked out of there and never smoked another cigarette again, ever in my life. It's not true. Smoked for 6 more months. Worst 6 months of my life. Every time I lit a cigarette, I could hear the gun go off. Yeah? Sometimes, man, if the paranoid, you look around and see somebody else that heard it, you know? You know I'm killing myself? Gave him up. Discovered a real interesting fact then. Cigarette tobacco in our country cured sugar. My body lost the major source of sugar. Now we wanted sugar. Real sugar. In serious quantities. Ate a lot of sugar. Ate so much, put on about 50 pounds more than I weigh now. And it all seemed for some reason to settle right in the middle. Shoulders stayed the same size. Feet stayed the same size. Chest didn't get any bigger. Just all came here.
And I treated it like strange. I'd be sitting home, I lived in Monmouth Field at the time, and I'd be sitting home in this little condominium in front of the fireplace, quiet, peaceful, saying to myself, 10 minutes to 11 at night, there's no sugar in the house, no ice cream in the house. And it's not necessary to be ice cream in the house. I don't have to have ice cream. I can have a glass of water like my neighbor, so to bed, go to sleep. It's not anything I need to concern myself with. 5 minutes till 11, I'm out the door on a dead run. In the car, 100 miles an hour down the Santa Ynez Road, broadside to the south, in front of 31 flavors in the village, and running through the door, the guy comes from the other side with the keys to lock up. Get my quart of pralines and cream, my jar of butterscotch topping, my jar of dry roasted cashews, and go home and get a bowl, and I don't mean a chicken shit cereal bowl. I mean a bowl, and make a sundae. Shortly after eating the sundae, I would blast into a quiet sugar coma. In front of the TV, which was good, because then I didn't have to deal with a relationship that I was in, which was on the rocks, and I don't want to talk to anybody about anything, because my parents never talk to each other about anything, so I just do what they do. I just don't talk, and when you get tired of living with this goddamn lounge with a couch lizard, you leave, you know. All the work in the past. Well, one day I bought pants. I don't remember how big they were, 30, 40, whatever the hell they were, but the next day I couldn't get them fastened. And I don't know what kind of meat, but I love it. Said to me, okay, look, you can eat anything you want to eat, any kind you want to eat, as much, as often, it doesn't matter. Have anything you want. What you cannot do is buy any pants any bigger than these. These are the largest pants you will ever own as long as you live. So if you want to spend every winter walking around in Hawaiian shirts, wearing them out so that people can't see you, can't fasten your pants, okay? Somebody came along and said to me, try red apples. Red is delicious apples. Every time you want sugar, eat a red delicious apple. Probably went through 36, 37 cases of red delicious apples. But it hasn't been necessary to eat sugar in probably about 9 years. Okay? Yeah, absolutely. That was a goddamn terrible. Anyhow, now friends come to me and say, now I'm starting to lose some weight, you know. Now friends come to me and they say to me, well, what you need to do now is exercise. Start running with us. You'll feel better, your lungs will get clean out, and you'll be able to run out a lot of your insanity. You can aerobically exercise out negative energy. True. True. I say this a lot, and I mean it. A lot of times, man, if you're totally stressed, instead of getting 7 meetings, 7 nights a week, you'd be better off get 4 meetings, 4 nights a week, and go bust your ass 3 nights a week in a gym. Deadly service, like that. Absolutely. I don't get a lot of shit on sitting around talking about, but when I get off that life cycle, I have lived into another dimension.
Nobody comes near me when I'm on that subject either. I'll tell you, well, even now, where I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in this nice, quiet little gym in the mountains, people just don't even ask me how much time I have left. Because they can see I'm trying to leave the planet.
If I ride that crap out, and I can leave and go into my day, I'm going to be totally nuts, you know. I can leave it perspire on the floor. If I start running, my friends come to me and say, look, you got a little problem. I think we're going to try and get your feet going straight. We can get your feet going straight, you can run further, faster, with less effort. We want you to go see this guy in Long Beach. He's a sports medicine podiatrist, the best in the world, and a marathon runner himself. I lived in Santa Monica at the time. Long Beach is 35 miles away. I will not drive you 35 miles to a doctor. There are people on the program who will tell you that's spiritual, that you will drive others further than you'll drive yourself. Move over and share if they tell you that. Not true. Really not true. So, I go see the psychiatrist in Century City, who's 5 minutes away from where I live, doesn't know anything about running. They make me orthotic. I go run 3 miles, and my back goes out, and I wind up somewhat bent over. Now my friends say to me, go see these guys in Pasadena. They are the best sports medicine chiropractors in the world. They work with the U.S. Olympic team. They'll have you on leg and erect in 3 days.
Pasadena is also 35 miles from Santa Monica. They're not driving me 35 miles to Pasadena, so I drive to Marina Del Rey, which is 5 minutes away. I go to a chiropractor who smokes cigarettes, who's about 75 miles overweight, who doesn't know what the word money means. When he finishes with me, I'm now like this. Finally, out of absolute complete desperation, I drive myself to Pasadena. My friends were right. 3 days, I'm a wreck. Feel fine. The doctors in Pasadena say, go to Long Beach. Again tomorrow, I go to Long Beach to drive myself to Long Beach. Finally, I get in this guy's office. I sit in that stupid chair where your feet are straight out in front of you. Into the room walks one of the nicest, kindest, most gentlest men I've ever met in my life. He says, hi, I'm John. Hi, I'm Bob. He walks right up to my right foot, picks it up, turns it a half a dozen different directions, looks at me, and he says, what happened to your foot when you were a kid? I said, probably. Because I don't remember anything from 15 years back. But by now I'm in therapy, and I've been in therapy for about a year because I wanted to die when I was 17 years old. I had written 32 inventories. I had probably driven 40,000 miles a year to participate in some kind of participation that had to do with recovery on some level for some program. Okay, and I've been doing it for most of my recovery. 17 years. That was the best program I knew of anybody I knew. And I wanted to die. Therapy was all the blessings. So when I went to therapy, and they used to tell me about my childhood, I couldn't. Because I couldn't remember it. It was all a blank. 15 years of it was a blank. So he says, well, what happened to your foot? I said, I don't know. Why? He says, well, it's practically what you call the foot. It's laid on its thigh. I said, well, maybe I was born that way. He says, no, it's not a birth defect. This is a structural change in the foot after you were born. It's nothing to do with before you were born. I got real uncomfortable. See, this is the thing I don't like about feelings. Feelings just sort of come up. They do not announce themselves. A little bellman doesn't come in and say, Bob, got about 5 minutes to get ready here. In 5 minutes, you're going to be so sad, you're going to want to die. For no apparent reason, you're just going to be sad and want to die. It just comes. Alright? My mind can't stand feelings because my mind must have control over me, over you, and over the environment in which we exist. At all costs. It takes things that just show up. That it can't get prepared. And if it can't get prepared, it fears exposure. You'll know something's wrong with me, and that you caught me off guard, and that I am not enough. Right? Okay. Now I feel very sad when he tells me this about my foot, and I feel very angry. I don't know what I'm sad about, and I don't know who I'm angry at. And I drive home to Santa Monica where I live, and I'm walking around, and I'm nuts, and I just don't know what the fuck to do, and I'm just like, wow. And the phone rings, and on the other end of the phone, because God has impeccable timing, is my mother, who has also just come from her foot doctor, who neglected to cut her toenails straight. And she's angry. And I said to her, look, as long as we're on the subject of feet, what happened to mine? For those of you who choose in your recovery at some time to go back on this big adventure and find out what happened to you when you were children, prepare yourself. Dealing with a co-alcoholic can be more difficult than dealing with the alcoholic. They don't know you were even there. They were born and raised and almost died in the kitchen. It's the only room in the house they know. It's the only room in the house they were ever in. And it's very hard to talk. After a little conversation back and forth, my mother finally said to me, look, when you were small, you had real high arches, and they had to buy you special shoes, and they were very expensive shoes. In the next 2 or 3 minutes, she repeats a number of times how expensive these shoes were. I hang up the phone, and I'm nuts. And I'm crazy, and I'm sick, and I want to throw up, and I want to tear the apartment apart, and I want to throw all the furniture. I live on the 17th floor, and I want to throw everything in the street, and I'm just fucking gone. And I pace all night long. I'm a pacer. I can't sit when I'm cooking and stuff. Next day comes, and off I go, and I'm in my therapist's office, and she says, hi, how are you? And I go, I don't say fine anymore. And she says, well, let's go back and see what we can find. And we went back, and what we found is me, 2.5 years old, in a hallway in a little apartment building in Denver, Colorado. Cute little fellow, blonde wavy hair, blue eyes, tears streaming down his face, standing in front of him in this hallway is his mother, my mother. I was trying to say he, I had to remove myself one step from the name. me standing there with my mother, and she's trying to find out why I'm crying. I'm explaining to this woman I'm crying because the shoe on my right foot is so small, it hurts so bad, the pain is so great that I have to cry, even though I'm afraid of crying because of my dad. My mother bends down closer to me and goes, "Shh, not too loud. Your father will hear, and he'll be angry." After I got through the initial reaction from that, which was the deep couch in my therapist's office, and put my knuckles in both hands to bleed, and cried and sobbed like I've never cried and sobbed in my life, I understood, and finally understood, why, all my life, I felt like something's wrong with me, and that I'm not enough. Because if you're the two big people in charge of my life, if I could give them to you when you were to raise me and clothe me and house me and feed me and love me and give you a sense of identity and importance, you can't even buy shoes for me to fit me. I must not be very important. I left there, called a doctor in Long Beach, and I said, "Could wearing the shoe design for a high arc that was too small turn the foot over?" He said, "Absolutely, that's probably what it is." I said, "Thank you." Then I tore up the dashboard in my car. But the pain was great. See, what I'm trying to say is this. Let me give it a better way. I had a friend of mine who was into both ACA and NA and MCA, and I think every program really used all of them, which most of it could fit in anyway. It really doesn't matter. And he was into an inventory, and he said, "Okay, I'm trying to do this childhood bullshit." He said, "Here's what I got to go for." There was this kid, Wilbur, down the street, man. He says, "I resented the hell," whatever, I'm sure he says, "I resented the hell out of Wilbur. Wilbur always got more presents than I did, and he always got more expensive presents than I did. Every year without fail, and I resented him." I said, "Yeah." And? He said, "What do you mean, what?" Says in here, you know, get the resentment down. I resented him. The kid got more toys, better toys, I resented him. What the fuck more do you want from him? I said, "The book says the exact nature of the wrong, man. The exact nature. Look the words up in the dictionary." I said, "In this instance, I would imagine the exact nature was this. Maybe you should go one step further and look at the fact that perhaps, because you identified the toys he was getting as love, and the toys he got represented the love you weren't getting, that's what he ate. Not because he had better toys." I said, "If you leave it lay, that you hate them because you got better toys, you look like an asshole. And the inventory is not designed to make us look bad. That was never what it was intended to do. It was intended for us to find out why. It was intended for us to set us free. First I knew what you were doing. There were no mistakes in those processes. They didn't put exact nature in there because they couldn't find any other words. You know, they consulted a couple of renowned psychiatrists at the time to help them with the process. It was sent to them before they were ever given to us. You know, and he suggested a couple of changes that were made. That stuff's real important. Real important. Because the thing that's critical and essential to my recovery is finding out that I'm okay. You know, I got a lot of work to do. Sure. This is the best I heard. You know, people always say, "Oh, God, forgive your mother and dad. They did the best job." Because some son of a bitch said that to me, I was 6 months old, lying to me, talking to some guy about, you know, what a no good drunken bum my father was. This guy wasn't even in the conversation. It's none of his goddamn business in the first place, right? Jumped up and said, "Hey, enough of that about your father. You forgive them. He did the best job he could for the tool he had." I thought about that for a moment, and intellectually that makes great sense. It really does. You know, if you need a hammer, you got a screwdriver, you're in serious trouble. Particularly if you need a big hammer, you got small screwdrivers. You're not going to get it done. You're not going to get the job done. You're not going to get it done because you don't have the tool. Okay, so they didn't have tools to make them do the job, so they have to give you another deal. Of course, then I go try some Christmas with my family, and all I can think about is getting a flamethrower and torching the whole house and the whole family. See? And I need to tell myself what a really rotten, no good kind of bitch I am, because now here I am in recovery, and I don't appreciate these wonderful, loving people.
Nothing's changed. Everybody who was drunk 20 years ago is still drunk. They're still telling the same stupid jokes, sitting in the same chair. The same 380-pound fat uncle that broke my electric train when I was five, who's not lost one pound or changed one goddamn bit. And he's still, nothing's changed. And I'm miserable. I don't go to prison anymore, by the way. Will not do that to myself. Maybe the day before, maybe a week later. I don't know when, but I ain't there Christmas Day. I'll spend Christmas home alone, and I have chosen to. A lot of presents for myself. I have a lot of teddy bears, about 70 of them, because I love them. Get all the bears out, put them in a circle around the tree, on the present. Put the turkey, make a few errors, put the turkey. Look at them, you know, you guys try. I would talk to a gourmet cook in Texas when I was cooking my turkey. She said, soda, a towel, and butter. Put the towel on the bird and then face the towel constantly with butter. You'll have tender, crunchy bird. Two things happened. One is the towel got done first. Secondly, I think I used it on the Majax. And the butter just started to be Ajax right into the bird with it. So, I had better turkeys perhaps on Christmas, but never one as rewarding. And I had a beautiful day by myself. I didn't know I had a beautiful day by myself. I didn't know that. I absolutely didn't know that. Anyway, I've spent years in recovery trying to forgive these goddamn people, saying I had forgiven them and not being able to spend 3 minutes with them without wanting to kill them. You know, think of my mother. Oh, God. I don't know. So, the best I've heard is, because I kept thinking that if I forgave them, it made what they did right. And if it made what they did right, it made me wrong. And I already thought I was wrong, and I didn't like feeling wrong. I don't like feeling like something's wrong with me. That's not a good feeling. It cripples me and handicaps me in my life, so I couldn't let it go. And then finally one day I meet this girl who's having her first birthday. And her mother, who had 4 years on the program and had no money, called her to buy her present for her first birthday. Called her up and said to her, look, on this your first birthday in AA, I want to give you a present. And the present is this. She said, I want you to know that I, your mother, am responsible for most of the problems you have in your life today. He says, I want you to know that I'm responsible that you can't have a meaningful relationship with a man. I'm responsible that you don't know how to hold a child. I'm responsible that you don't know how to buy nice clothes and make yourself up. I'm responsible that you don't know how to take care of yourself. I'm responsible for these things. And she said, but if this is your first birthday, please understand, you're responsible for the solution. I can live with that. I can handle that. That's fine by me. Okay, you blew it. Mom and Dad fucked up. Did the best job they could, but it's wrong. It's criminally punishable in court of law, the job they did. It's not okay. No, it's not okay. It's wrong. But I'm the only one who can do anything about it. They can't fix it. I have to fix it. I've got to go get the new information. I've got to find the books to read. I've got to get the extra tools I need in recovery to make me feel good. I'm the one that's got to change it. Nobody else can do it. I don't mind that. As long as I don't feel like something's wrong with me and I'm not enough, I can do pretty good with that stuff. I stand a chance. And I got to tell you, for all of us, man, today, it's okay. I wouldn't change a thing. 24 years clean and sober, 50 years old. In the top 1% in the nation for men my age, you know, for health, for over capacity. I'm totally vegetarian, believe in exercise. I don't eat meat, I don't eat dairy products, I don't eat sugar, I don't eat a lot of things. My health is great because I have a very important goal in my life now. I want to die of old age. I'm serious. I want to die of old age. I do not want to die from a goddamn degenerative disease. I do not want to rot to death because of what I ate, what I drank, or what I smoked. I want to walk out on the front porch at 127 years of age with my mind still working, sit down in a rocking chair, and go on to whatever the hell the next dimension is. That's what I want. And I believe I have some control of that.
People always say, what's recovery about? What's this? What's that? And one of the things you've got to remember this. God, please try and remember this. If you're not doing any of this stuff, it's only because you don't know how. It's not because you're a bad person. It's not because there's something wrong with you. You don't know how. So if you care about any of this stuff, and it's important to you in your recovery, then go find out how. You want to stop smoking? Go ask somebody to quit smoking. You want to find out about eating nutritionally so you can quit fucking yourself up with food? Go talk to somebody that understands food and nutrition and food allergies and things like that. You know, it's not all our fault, guys. If you're eating crap you're allergic to, you're going to crave it. You'll learn it. Try to get it.
Just let go. My things are salt and grease. Oh, God.
I occasionally, even today, will walk into the store nonchalantly and buy a can of Planters roasted peanuts and oil and salt.
Cashews, actually.
Walk out of the store firmly convinced that I'm going to take this can of oil and salt home and have three or four.
Perhaps a few left for in the morning.
Forget it. The can will not see midnight. It will be gone. Because I'm allergic to that stuff.
Man, I get it. I want more. You know, I really need more.
I share a quick story about a friend of mine. Because that kind of is the epitome of everything I believe. About 6 years ago, they told a dear friend of mine, his office 24 years old, and was like, you know, 19 years old then. And he was about 56 then, 55 years old, and he had cancer, and to make his arrangements, it was over. And Fred already started to get interested in, you know, running a little bit. And so he said, no, I don't think so. You know? He said to the doctor, I ain't done, man. I don't think this is it. I'm just not done. So whatever treatment he described, he listened to it. On top of that, man, he began to, you know, change all of his diet, cigarettes disappeared from his life, changed everything in life. He had to exercise more, ran more, began to bicycle, began to swim, began to do everything that he felt he could do, because he just knew his heart, man. That little light, that little glimmer, that little spark in there, everybody in this room is really going to live more than anything else in the world, is just to hold him up. Last November, 6 years later, 61 years of age, Fred was over in, on the Big Island of Hawaii for a little event called the Iron Man. His cancer had been in remission for a year. He's 24 years sober, 61 years old. Fred entered the Iron Man, and he managed to complete the 2.4-mile ocean swim and 112-mile bicycle ride and 26-mile run in 15 hours. Okay? Happy World Recovery now. You just heard. God bless you.